Accession number 27347, Reel 13.
Stanley Brand, Reel 13.
Scrawled in the wardrobe were things like "Kilroy was here." That was the first time I'd heard the, or first time I'd seen the expression. I still don't know who Kilroy was, but it struck me as being lacking in sensitivity to put it up in a mahogany wardrobe in such luxurious surroundings, especially if they'd been used to army or wartime service facing hardships. We were employed to do lookouts and sentry duty. I don't know why we were chosen for this, whether it was a case of being trustworthy and therefore beyond suspicion. We were told to act as sentries in the area where the pregnant American servicewomen were going back to the States. It was rumoured that one or two of them had set up business in the lifeboats. We were told to stop it. stop the rough lads getting past. We were leading naval airmen, second class, and the people aboard the Elizabeth didn't realise that there was a big void between leading naval airmen and leading aircraftsmen. Leading naval airmen were equivalent to corporal, whereas leading aircraftsmen were below that, just above able seamen. So because they weren't sure of what our rank meant, sometimes we were given jobs which we thought were beneath our dignity, like clearing up the tables after a meal. We refused to do it because we were not going to wait upon RAF aircraftsmen. And yet when it came to taking responsibility, not everybody was ready to assert the authority of their rank. You can't have it both ways, but a lot of people thought they could. And so it went on. The food was marvellous. Hot. They only served two meals a day to us, and but there were naffy canteens aboard where you could get anything else in the way of food or drink, and chocolate bars. I know that they were Hershey chocolate bars, American make, which tasted different, but it was chocolate and it was unlimited. We hadn't a lot of money after Blackpool, but it's amazing how much money was found to buy chocolate bars. Another thing that took money was the Crown and Anchor schools that set up. The regular staff aboard Elizabeth were out to use Crown and Anchor boards and housey-housey to extract as much money as they could from the passenger troops. I was so taken with Crown and Anchor that I very nearly bought a board. If I'd had the money, I would have, because I saw how much it was in favour of the owner of the board compared with the punter. Anyway, it took 4 days to get across the Atlantic.
Could I ask how Crown Anchor's played?
It's a dice game. And you place your bets on the crowns or the anchors, and depends what comes up on the dice, whether it's a crown or an anchor. It's such a simple game, but compared with the dice and compared with a number of crowns and anchors on the board, it was definitely in favour of the owner of the board. Yes, it took 4 days to cross, and the word went round that we were coming into New York. And sure enough, there on the horizon, the Statue of Liberty. We must have been like all the poor immigrants who went over there during the Irish famine, and so we lined the rail and we gawped at this symbol of freedom, and were suitably impressed. Word also went round that there was a strike of the longshoremen. I think it was longshoremen. Oh dear, I can't remember the names. Tugboat men. Anyway, there was a strike of the people who would have piloted the Elizabeth into the docking area, and we thought we were going to anchor outside and have a long wait till the strike came. But the captain of the Elizabeth wasn't going to be deterred by anything like a strike, and he took her in. And we all watched, and he edged it in, and the Queen Elizabeth, 80-odd thousand tons, she kissed the pier as if she'd been a long-lost friend, you know, just moved in and parked perfectly. We felt immensely proud of the uniform that we had. Anyway, we had to fall in and march off down the quayside to buses, and the buses took us, I think it was to Union Station. It was a huge station, a huge hall, terrific height, with echoes everywhere. Very impressive. Onto a troop train. But what a difference to the troop train we'd been on in England. I think that the troop train was one that had been used between the wars for immigrants. Spartan in some ways, but compared with the one from Squire's Gate up to Glasgow, it was heaven. And the food, we were issued with packed meals which had fruit and candy bars and soft drinks in cartons and sandwiches the bit of bread above hardly knew there was a bit of bread below because it was so far away. There's so much meat in between. But that wasn't enough. We pulled into a siding, and the Canadian Army were there with their mobile kitchens, field kitchens, and they served us up with a sirloin steak. First of all, we had a beef stew, and then a sirloin steak with chips, deep-fried onion rings, which we'd never seen before. Well, the chips were called French fries. We didn't know what French fries were. We knew them as chips. Deep-fried onion rings, battered, which we'd never seen before, never heard, never thought of. And tomatoes, sliced tomatoes fried, and they were 4 and 5 inches across. I've never seen tomatoes that size in my... We thought it was some sort of vegetable. Anyway, the Canadian Army proved that their army marched on its stomach. It was wonderful. And to 18-year-olds who'd been used to British rations, this was an eye-opener. We headed up to Moncton in New Brunswick, a journey which took about, I think it was about 18 hours. It must have been more than 18 hours. It must have been over 24 hours, because it was light when we left New York, and yet it was in the night when we arrived at Moncton. And there was deep snow on the ground in Moncton. But the snow had been cleared by hand or by snow ploughs or bulldozers, I don't know what, but the roads were cleared and we drove through big embankments of snow. This was all new to us and interesting. But we got to the RAF station at Moncton, which was a posting station. And it was amazing. All the rooms, all the billets, which were in blocks, two-story blocks, were running at temperatures which must have been well over 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And to walk in between, the steam pipes that were used for steam heating these places ran in trenches, and all the walkways were along the top of the trench on paving, so that it doesn't matter how much it snowed, they all cleared themselves. They didn't even have to commandeer the forces to go and dig themselves out. Again, organisation. And when we got into our billets, we found that there was already organisation to issue us with Canadian money. I forget how much it was, but it must have been somewhere around about $5, which was just over a pound. Remembering that our pay was 2 shillings a day. Plus flying pay. No, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. As acting leading airman, our pay had gone up. I think it was 3 and 6 a day. And flying pay. We probably were getting something like 8 shillings and 6 pence a day, which was heaven sent. Anyway, we got the pay and we were allowed off camp, and this too was an eye-opener. All the ice cream bars, Irish and Italian families had set up businesses, lots of things to eat. The shops were full of everything imaginable. We didn't really need to go off camp, because they had everything on camp. Cinemas, hospital, everything. But, of course, the town was an eye-opener to us as well. The only thing was, no pubs. All liquor had to be bought from a liquor store, and you had to register to get your liquor ration. You weren't allowed to open a bottle. If you had an unsealed bottle of liquor on the street you could be put into jail and fined. So we got our ration, but we took it back to camp with us. We there found that it was illegal to have liquor on camp as well. But the local padre had a terrific list of civilians who would welcome Britishers into their homes, and if we turned up with liquor there, we were even more welcome. Most of them had nubile daughters of marriageable age, and I think the thought of hitching up with a Britisher was attractive to them. We were very welcome. They made so much of us, and generally the mothers of these families would write to our families at home to tell them that we were all right, we were healthy and happy. And to get a letter from somebody who was looking after us was a great consolation to my mother. It was a lovely gesture, greatly appreciated. The hospitality was marvellous. Bitterly cold. We found that it was no good wearing lots of underclothing, because the rooms were so hot that if you went from outdoors to indoors, you needed to be able to dispense with the majority of your warm clothing, which meant that if you'd gone for double underclothing, it was damned inconvenient. The main thing was to wear hefty pullovers. But the cold was intense, bitterly cold, dry cold. Our ears were the main sufferers. I got chilblains on my ears. And we soon learned to go and look for earmuffs in the local shops. And we also bought helmets with ear flaps, like trappers. And nearly all servicemen were wearing these without any complaint from up above. And yes, the Canadians were wonderfully helpful and receptive. I heard it said amongst our friends in the billet that the Canadian girls were so knowing. They'd enter into a petting session and they knew just how to and when to fend off the opposition. Our boys were so disappointed. We were there for a fortnight, but it was a fortnight that sticks in the memory. And then we were mustered with all our kit, flying kit, and a naval deep sea kit bag, which had all our other belongings in it, on a bitterly cold parade ground, which had been cleared of snow but was very icy and slippery. And we were bussed to the local railway station, and once again onto a troop train. This was a troop train which definitely had been designed for immigrants, and for long journeys, for journeys of up to a week. It had all the facilities, it had means for boiling water so that we could make tea, and we bought tea bags because we'd been warned of this. It had beds, bunks which let down from the roof, from the passenger racks. The trouble is the seats were laths, wooden strips with gaps in between, and they left indelible marks on our backsides. Very uncomfortable. Restricted the circulation so that you got pins and needles in your bum, which isn't very pleasant. We travelled for 24 hours on that, overnight. There weren't enough drop-down bunks for us all, so we arranged a rota that you had so long on the wooden seats and so long on the let-down bunk. And we pulled into a siding in Montreal. And we were told that we could leave the sidings as long as we were back. I think it was in 12 hours, something like that. It was 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. We were allowed out. So along with my immediate chums, we pooled some money and we collared a taxi and said, we'd like to see the city. I think there were five of us, and I think we raised $15 in the kitty. We'd like to see as much of the city as we can for $15. So off we went. And we were talking on the way, I suppose, in the back seat, and we saw all the usual sights, but we'd been talking about the breakfast that we'd had on board the troop train, which was not so good. It was rather sparse for some reason, very unlike most of the Canadian arrangements. Anyway, the taxi driver pulled up outside what looked like a bed and breakfast place. There was a veranda with about five steps up. So he said, come on boys, this is it. And we thought, we're going to get some breakfast. But we were worried about our shortage of money. Anyway, we started to go up the steps, and suddenly the door at the back of the veranda opened, and a Canadian naval lieutenant, straight-ringed lieutenant, Royal Canadian Navy lieutenant, came out. So one of our number, with officer-like qualities, called us to attention. We were on the steps, so we lined the steps, and this Canadian lieutenant came down looking very bashful, very embarrassed, and walked down in between us. After he'd gone, we continued on up the steps and went in. And the lady of the house, who I suppose she looked like an aged 50. She said, be ready for you in a few minutes, boys. Sit down. So we sat down in what appeared to be an ante room. And we sat there for a few minutes. Didn't smell any bacon and eggs or lots of perfume. And then there was the door opened and rustling came in, a rustling noise with it, and in came five naked ladies with diaphanous sort of shawls, enough to let us see their wares anyway. Well, you'd just think that we were a flight of aircraft that had suddenly seen Fokker Wolf 109s or something. We peeled off and we were out of that and down the stairs. We're frightened to death. We all remembered the film that we'd been shown at Leon Soland of the multicoloured, technicolour effects of venereal diseases. Well, we piled into the taxi, and a few minutes later the taxi driver came out, obviously very annoyed, very upset. I don't know whether he'd missed his commission or whether he'd missed benefits in kind. I rather suspect it was benefits in kind. And he was very upset with us. So we decided to abandon and go back to the sidings. Well, we went into the train, and the rest, quite a few of the rest of the course were there because they hadn't saved any money, and they'd soon lost interest in the town, and they made us go over it in detail. And every time two or three young fellas came back in afterwards, come on, tell them what happened. So we were repeating the story over and over and over again. Particularly about the Canadian lieutenant who looked so embarrassed. Anyway, we passed time until we set off again for Kingston, Ontario. And for some reason, the quality of food given to us at Montreal was so much superior to anything else we'd had from Moncton onwards. At Kingston, once again, into buses and out to the airfield, where we were greeted like royalty. Everything was laid on. Terrific efficiency. They even had a record of what money had been issued to us since we arrived in Canada, and a special payment was organised so that we had money right from the moment we arrived. Even the people who'd drawn their maximum allowance were allowed an overdraft, and we all had money. We had wonderful billets, and we were excused all duties, I think for 3 days, so that we could bed in and find our feet in the new surrounding. But then the pressure started. As soon as we were allocated to a flight, the pressure was on. We got very little time off. We were organised into two watches again, so that you'd have morning flying, afternoon ground subjects. Next day it would be reversed. And the other half were opposite to what we were.